COVID-19 vaccinations for young children are now available. What should you know? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Parents can now get young children ages 5 and up vaccinated against the COVID virus, but some are hesitant and don't feel there's enough information. We're going to hear from two doctors about the vax for kids, and they'll take your questions. Also, Governor Ron DeSantis is waging a fight with President Biden over vaccinations and mask mandates. A court has sided with the governor for now. We'll look into that fight and the special legislative session that's coming up. And finally, we're losing many Holocaust survivors to time, but there are grandchildren fighting to keep their legacies and stories alive. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Well, vaccinations are now available for young children ages 5 and up, but there are a lot of parents who are hesitant. Today, we're going to ask the experts, and they will take your questions. So if you have a question about vaccines for your kids, text that question in now at 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. You can always email us your question, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Well, joining us is Dr. Eileen Marty. She's an infectious disease expert with Florida International University and is on the Miami-Dade COVID-19 Task Force. Dr. Marty, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
And Dr. Marcos Mestre is a chief medical officer at Nicklaus Children's Hospital. Dr. Mestre, thank you for the time.
Thank you for having me, Luis.
You know what, Dr. Mestre, I want to start with you. You work closely with parents and kids. What are you seeing? Is there an eagerness from guardians and parents to get their kids vaccinated?
I think it's somewhat split, similar to when we started vaccinating for those 12 and above. Certain parents are very excited. I can tell you most pediatrician parents are very excited. Part of it being that us as pediatricians have seen how COVID can affect even these younger age groups. So I can definitely tell you the pediatric population in terms of physicians and staff are very excited to have this vaccine available to help prevent these infections and some of the hospitalizations that we've seen in this age group.
You know, Dr. Marty, since the beginning of this pandemic, you and I have talked a lot about the debate over vaccines and how that conversation just has shifted and changed and evolved. But now that we have vaccines for kids, what are you hearing?
So it's a pleasure to be here with Dr. Mestre. It's really a privilege. He's a phenomenal pediatrician. I have to concur with him with the types of things that I'm hearing from parents and people who've been on the front line and seen children be very, very ill, be hospitalized, be in the ICU. And we have had children have died of COVID here in Miami-Dade. And we've had quite a few children that have had the very rare multisystem inflammatory syndrome. So most of the parents who contact me about vaccinating their children are actually eager and are trying to figure out how to get their child vaccinated. And when the families are eager to get the child vaccinated, I find that the children share that sense of excitement and become very eager to get their vaccines as well. So it really is a reflection with what, you know, the mood of the parent that you see the eagerness or not in the part of the child.
Again, I want to put the number out there. The text number is 786-677-0767. That's 786-677-0767. You can always email us your question, sundial@wlrnnews.org. I know that we've talked about the chances of children getting COVID and the number of children who where COVID-19 can become very serious and how many die. We did get a question from one of our listeners, Sean Patrick Perez from Facebook. He had posted the question, wants to know how likely it is that a child could die from COVID compared to an adult. Dr. Mestre, what are the odds? Is it better for children than it is for someone like me, my age?
Yeah, thankfully for children, it's very uncommon to see a death It's definitely less than 1%, more like 0.01%. But what I do want to emphasize to the audience is many times we look at it as death or no death. And I think that's the wrong way to look at it because of the effects that this could have just in terms of hospitalization, having long-term complications from the multi-system inflammatory syndrome. So again, even though it's not that the child will die, but they could have long-term implications on it. And on top of that, that we now know that the children can spread the virus to others and those who may be more vulnerable than them. So looking at it just from a mortality standpoint, I think is not the appropriate approach, but looking at it more from a public health and an individual effect on the child is probably the best approach.
Dr. Martin,
if I may, if I could just add, I'd love to dovetail on that. We know of more than 1.9 million cases in children in the United States alone, and over 8,300 children have been hospitalized with COVID-19. And that's talking in the 5 to 11 range. It's even greater than that if you talk about the entire span. So just in the 5 to 11 range, there's been 2,316 cases of that MISC. And that's nothing to sneeze at. That's really a tremendously alarming number. And it's over 5,000 if you consider all age groups. In children in that 5 to 11 group, there's been 94 deaths from COVID-19. And I totally agree with Dr. Merrick. There is no question that we have to look beyond just one part of the statistics and see the entire picture for these children. We have no idea what the long-term effect is going to be on children who manifested almost nothing when they originally were infected with the virus. This virus will change them for the rest of their lives, for good or for ill. And it's really a very good thing to avoid getting that infection for children and for everyone else.
Yeah, and we talk about this idea of waiting to see. And we, look, we're only barely a couple of years into this and understanding what the virus can do to us, but also what we know about the vaccines that we've created. Dr. Mestre, you know, I mean, I saw this statistic that a third of American parents want to wait and see how well the vaccine works for children. This was a Kaiser Family Foundation poll taken at the end of October. And I'm wondering, typically, what is it they're waiting to see? What do they want to see before they feel comfortable?
I think, and I understand the hesitancy as a father of three myself and a father of a nine-year-old that's waiting to get vaccinated. Most parents want to say, okay, I want to see more numbers. In the initial study from Pfizer, it's a little bit over 2,200 children that were vaccinated. But we've seen in terms of those 12 to 15 age range that, or 17 age range that have received the vaccines and have done very well, and it's safe and effective. So part of it is just kind of hearing what we see on the media and misinformation that sometimes is promoted. And unfortunately, leads to some doubts. But I get it. And our jobs as pediatricians is to offer that information to them and provide them with the facts that this vaccine has been very safe. It's been very effective. It's a lower dose than what the vaccine was offered to those 12 and above. That dose was 30 micrograms, where this dose is 10 micrograms, so a third of the dose. And from the study that was done on over 2,200 individual children, there was minimal to no side effects in those children. So very promising results and with very good efficacy, with 91% of those individuals being protected from infection.
And Dr. Marty, I mean, because part of that survey, the parents were talking about the sample size and saying, I'm not comfortable with that small a sample size. I want a lot more. Does the number of kids studied, does that matter in the efficacy in making parents feel comfortable?
Sure, and that's a very good question. And that's why the Pfizer was asked by the federal government to double the number of children who received it to see if they could find any cases of any kind of problem. And they doubled the number of children who received the actual vaccine as opposed to placebo. And there were zero cases of myocarditis in that 5 to 11 group. Really, what we're talking about are really mild symptoms that we're all used to getting from vaccines is pretty much what we found in that age group, sore arm, maybe fatigue, maybe a little fever for a couple of days, nothing serious, nothing that you're not going to get over, and really just proof that the immune system is working. So once the numbers were expanded to that much larger total number of kids, and we didn't just look at the number of kids here in the United States that were part of the study, but also in Poland and Finland and Spain as well. The children were from every ethnic group, and it continues to show that there was just no safety signal. This is a very safe vaccine in that age group. Dr. Mester is absolutely right. It's a third of the dose, and it is based on age because we're talking about how the immune system ages. It's not about the weight of the child. And if you want to know, actually, if somebody is going to get their first shot and they're 11 years old and they're going to turn 12 by the time that that it's time for the second dose, we're going to go ahead and give them the lower 10 dose and then the 30 dose when they turn 12. And it's not going to make any difference whatsoever.
Is it about age or is it about your size, your weight?
It's about age. It's the cells of our immune system, the way our immune system works, is pretty much, you could just sort of think of it as our own bodies aging, right? And so as we get older, we look a little different, we get little size difference, hair is different, etc. And so our immune cells age as well, and as they age, they respond a little differently to different medications and different vaccines, and so we're basing it on age.
Again, I'm talking with Dr. Eileen Marty, infectious disease expert at FIU. Also with Dr. Marcos Mestre, the chief medical officer at Nicklaus Children's Hospital. And again, talking about the vaccine now available for children 5 and up. And if you've got a question about that because you're thinking about getting your child vaccinated, text in your question to 786-677-0767 or email us. sundial@wlrnnews.org. We got another question that came in, this from Dan Hoffman in Hollywood. He asks, there's a study going on about how the COVID vaccine affects menstrual cycles. Should I be concerned about vaccinating my daughters who are ages 5, 7, and 12? Dr. Mestre?
Yeah, at this point, there's no indications that would be of any harm to the female reproductive system. There have been case reports of those individuals that are over 12 and over that have been able to receive the vaccine and are menstruating. Case reports of abnormalities in their menstrual cycle, but that was short-lived, as any stress on the body, be it an infection, mental stress, whatever it might occur, sometimes that may lead to some abnormalities in the menstrual cycle, which then return to normal once that stress is over. And the same can occur with vaccines. So the NIH has funded certain studies in terms of seeing if there is any prolonged abnormalities in terms of the menstrual cycle. And those studies are ongoing now, but from what we can see, there is no effect, long-term effects from the menstrual cycles, and also no effects on pregnancy in terms of being able to become pregnant or having any consequences of receiving the vaccine while pregnant.
Yeah, you know, Dr. Marty, one of the other things too is that with children, you know, they have other vaccinations they have to get before going to school. And of course, that was a concern even before the COVID vaccine with some parents. But, you know, if it comes to getting those vaccines and now the COVID vaccine, what do you tell parents?
So I'm really glad you asked that question. And I also want to dovetail on what Dr. Mestre said and what he's describing there for checking about menstrual cycles and fertility and all that just goes to show the detail and the effort that has gone into assuring the safety of these vaccines and as well as the efficacy. And I can tell you point blank that when you look at the safety and efficacy data of these vaccines for COVID-19 and compare them to many of the vaccines that we routinely give to our children, these are phenomenal. These are doing very well in terms of safety and efficacy, among the very best vaccines we've ever had. And I think that's something that our parents need to know when they realize that this is going to prevent a horrible viral infection, prevent possible long-term complications to from having had the infection to their child. And because, as Dr. Mestre said, there is a reduced spread by the children, it's going to prevent problems to family members that are even more vulnerable to this virus.
I wondered if, what do we know so far about natural immunity? And if a child has gotten COVID, what have we learned about what that natural immunity is? Is it still too early to tell, Dr. Marty?
Thank you. So that's a wonderful question. And we are still trying to sort out all the different types of studies that are being done regarding natural immunity. What we do know is that in this study, in which the children were enrolled to either get placebo or get the BioNTech Pfizer vaccine, there was no distinction made when the children were recruited as to whether they had or had not had COVID-19. And so in that group that received the vaccine, again, there were no safety problems, and they had excellent response to the vaccine, whether or not they had had COVID. Now, there are a lot of data that do indicate that having had COVID and then getting a vaccine does lead to very good, what we call hybrid immunity. In part because you have these memory cells that were developed at the time that you got your initial infection that are reminded to come back in force, and you get more what we call somatic hypermutation of the already existing cells, receptors, like their little antibodies and so forth, and they work really, really well against this. However, one other thing that you have to bear in mind about natural immunity is that a very significant portion, it depends on which study you look at, a very significant portion of the people who have natural immunity never develop good neutralizing antibodies. So somewhere around 25% just don't do it.
Right.
And one of the things that we do know is if you take these vaccines, which have their spike modified in a hardened form, then you're exposing the immune system to that exact part of the virus that is most sensitive to the virus in a form that they do develop these high quality neutralizing antibodies.
Dr. Mestre, you mentioned this a little while ago. I just wanted to double check on this again with children getting the vaccine. I know with us adults, sometimes there were side effects, whether it was fever, fatigue, things like that. Do children face the same sort of side effects?
Yeah, they face a similar side effect profile, but not to the extent as we had seen with the 30 microgram dose. The typical side effects that you might see is some pain at the injection site, some probably some decrease in energy, some malaise, as we describe in the medical field, perhaps some lymphadenopathy, which is enlargement of the lymph node, perhaps under the armpit, that could occur. And typically, they may see a small degree of fever that could typically occur after the second dose. But as compared to the initial dosing with the 30 micrograms, it seems to be a little less in terms of those side effects that we're seeing in this age population as based on the study.
And the other thing I wanted to ask, too, is because we talked about vaccinations for kids, as I mentioned with Dr. Marty, that, you know, there are vaccines that they have to get to go to school. And now we've seen the Los Angeles Unified School District, the second largest in the country, they've announced they're going to require students 12 and older to be vaccinated, for COVID. Do you see, like with measles, mumps, any of the other ones, that this too should be something that should be mandated? Dr. Mestre.
Yeah, at this point, I think we're still trying to learn about this, just in terms of how, to Dr. Marty's points, how does the body respond to if you've had the infection? Is this something that children are going to need boosters on a yearly basis? Those type of things, similar to the flu. So this time, I think it's a little too early to tell in terms of whether we're going to see this as a requirement, especially in terms of for what we're seeing in the community as well. Are we seeing the surges that here in South Florida every summer to the extent it's affecting a large population of individuals? And then perhaps it would make more sense to make it mandatory. you know, at this time, we're trying to figure out more of it. And as we get more information to those that have been infected, and how does that play a part into those that would require immunizations or not? But again, I think the time will tell, and we'll be able to make a better decision as we get more information.
Yeah, and from the two of you, just briefly, Dr. Bestry, I'll start with you. What advice do you give to parents if they're weighing this out right now? What should they be asking themselves?
Yeah, the two main points I make to parents is, number one, the vaccine's safe, and number two, the vaccine's effective. From what I try to recommend to folks is doing it on a risk-benefit analysis. The risk of getting infections are much higher than any risk that we see of receiving the vaccines. We've had our hospital full with our COVID unit full with COVID patients here in the summertime, and we've had very limited folks that had the myocarditis effect from the vaccine at that point. So when I look at those figures and I see it, it just makes obvious sense to me to go ahead and get your children vaccinated. I'm vaccinating my three children. Yes, most pediatricians will vaccinate their children. So to make sure that they understand that it's safe and effective.
And Dr. Marty, what would you tell parents right now?
Well, this is one of the safest and most efficacious of the vaccines that we have that control and really work against infections. So I would absolutely advocate it. Moreover, going back to the previous conversation about mandating or not mandating, at this point, since it's under emergency use authorization, I don't think it should be mandated, but it should certainly be strongly recommended. However, once it finishes going through all the appropriate time and reviews and more people are vaccinated in that age range, and it does achieve full licensure from the FDA, then it should be like any vaccines that we currently have, and it should be part of what we do to keep our schools and our communities safe.
And you know what, when that comes up, we will definitely have a program to talk about it. But I want to thank my guest, Dr. Eileen Marty, infectious disease expert at FIU. Also want to thank Dr. Marcos Mestre, the chief medical officer at Nicklaus Children's Hospital. A lot of great information, and hopefully will help a lot of parents as they make their decision. Dr. Marty, Dr. Mestre, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Liz.
Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to meet two grandchildren of Holocaust survivors who are fighting to keep history alive. But first, our governor is fighting the president again over vaccines. Who's winning so far? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The federal government's vaccine mandate was quickly brought to a halt, being blocked by the courts just a little over a day after it took effect. Florida was one of more than two dozen states that have set out to sue the Biden administration over the order. Private companies and religious organizations have also joined in going to court. Governor Ron DeSantis took it a step further yesterday, announcing a set of bills that would put more obstacles on COVID mandates. Joining us now is Politico reporter Gary Fineout. All right, Gary, first let's start with this. What is the federal vaccine mandate requiring exactly?
Well, there's three separate sets of mandates. There's a mandate for federal contractors. There's a mandate for health providers that receive Medicare and Medicaid funding. And then the one that has gotten the most attention is the one for private employers. Businesses that have 100 or more employees are required to have their employees vaccinated by the beginning of January, or they can put in other types of steps, including like if you do masking and testing and things of that nature. So there are some ways to get around the vaccine mandate, but one of the big things about this has been this whole tug of war as to who's going to pay for the testing. The Biden administration proposal does not say that it would pay for the testing. However, there are some suggestions that maybe the employers have to pay for the testing under other federal laws.
So you have the federal mandate. Again, lawsuits came out. Florida joined in. The most recent action was a court temporarily blocking the nationwide mandate. Where does that stand now then?
Well, where that stands right now is very interesting. Is that so? The Fifth Circuit, which covers Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, put a stay on the mandate, And but the White House has basically told businesses they should still move forward. Part of their argument is that, well, the mandate is a requirement that has not yet gone into effect. As I stated, the masking requirements are going to kick in December. The vaccine requirements don't kick in until January. And so part of what the pushback from the Biden administration in their filing was along the sense is like, well, you don't have the right to stay this because actually the mandate's not in place. So but the long and short of it is there are multiple lawsuits in multiple jurisdictions. And as I understand it, there will be some sort of lottery on November 16th to sort of decide which case is going to be the main case and that the other ones are going to be subservient to as this goes through the legal process.
And so the Governor DeSantis has called these mandates unconstitutional and illegal. I mean, we've been dealing with this now for more than a year. So does he have an argument or this hasn't been resolved yet?
Well, the situation with the OSHA mandates is absolutely something that is actionable at this point in time, because obviously OSHA did not issue its formal rule until last week. And they're doing it under an emergency status. And DeSantis has criticized that and saying, well, this was announced 2 months ago and it's not going to go into effect for two more months. How is this an emergency? But beyond that, OSHA has a very mixed track record when it tries to carry out emergency rules. They have had some emergency rules in the past struck down by the courts. So it's a mixed bag. But his point is that, look, the governor believes that there is not legal authority from Congress to do this. Now, if you read the Biden administration brief, they're like, no, well, OSHA has pretty broad authority in their argument that they do have a broad authority and that there have been other cases in the past. But again, it kind of part of it flows into this whole thing is this an emergency? Of course, the Biden administration says there will be they use the words grave danger unless something is done in the near future.
And just a reminder, OSHA, of course, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. We've seen we've seen private companies and religious groups and more than half the states join in with this lawsuit. Has this been a bipartisan push, or is it just really we're seeing it push from Republicans?
It's largely Republicans. It's largely Republican attorney generals who have been the main ones pushing it. Now, as noted, there is not unanimity among Democrats about this. Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, who is a Democrat who is challenging DeSantis, has basically made her point that she does not agree with mandates. She does not think there should be a vaccine mandate. Nonetheless, she's been critical of DeSantis's push to tell businesses what they can and can't do, and has suggested that is a hypocritical move on his part. But in regards to the legal action, I think pretty much it's being driven by Republican attorney generals across the state. And then, of course, as you noted, being joined by various businesses.
What impact is it having on companies and workplaces who are eager to follow the mandate?
Well, I think the issue is, and that's what we're going to kind of come to bear in all this over the next few weeks, is that you are creating a sort of potential dynamic of dueling sets of directives, especially since Florida is poised to hold a special session. They're going to put in their own laws related to vaccine mandates, and yet you have these other sets of rules that are in place by the federal government. I think there's a lot of questions as to how is this going to affect different industries. We're talking primarily about the one involving large private employers, but that rule with healthcare providers is pretty significant as well. I mean, you have healthcare institutions in Florida who rely very heavily on federal funding. And so you're going to have a difficulty if you suddenly have the state government saying to them, well, you can't do this, and you have the federal government saying, well, you need to do this or your funding's in jeopardy.
I would think
for businesses, this is a bit unsettling.
You talked about that special session that's coming up on the 15th. The governor announced a couple of bills yesterday that he wants, again, to put a stop on these federal mandates. Remind us of what he's pushing.
Well, that's a very interesting situation. The governor has made himself abundantly clear over the last few months that he is dead set against what he calls, you know, vaccine mandates, the jab, as he calls it, or the shot. No one should lose their job for a shot. But when you get into the fine print of what actually got proposed, you saw that there was probably some back channel discussions related to what the legislature was willing to accept and what they were not willing to say. So the first thing to remember is the main bill that's coming up next week is not a blanket ban on vaccine mandates for private employers. Instead, it says if you are a private employer and you want to impose vaccine mandates, you have to have a series of exemptions. Now, some of these exemptions actually kind of mirror the exemptions that are in the federal rule, such as you need to have if you have testing, or you need to provide testing, or you need to provide PPE, which is masks. But there's also religious exemptions and medical exemptions and things of that nature. The other important thing to that's interesting about the proposals that came out yesterday is the governor had talked about several things that he was thinking about doing to sort of compel businesses to get on board with this. And some of those did not wind up in the final bill that has emerged from the legislature. The governor had discussed stripping COVID-19 liability protections from businesses. I don't know if you recall, but in the spring, the legislature passed a law that said, well, because of all the things with COVID, a lot of businesses, you are going to be immune from certain types of litigation related to COVID-19. The governor had suggested that you could lose those protections if you had a vaccine mandate. He had also suggested that he had floated the idea that if you had an adverse reaction to a vaccine, you could file for workers' compensation. Those are not in the bill. Yeah. Now, what is in the bill is the Attorney General can investigate and fine businesses up to, for large employers, it could be $50,000 per incident. And then there is, there's some other stuff in there as well, dealing with mask mandates and quarantines and stuff like that.
It's something that we'll follow very closely. Again, that special session starting up next week, and The regular session starts up in January, so plenty to discuss. Very interesting stuff. Wondering why this is happening now, but then again, we shouldn't really be surprised. I want to thank our guest, Politico reporter Gary Finout. Check out his reporting on this on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Gary, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, we're going to hear from the grandchildren of Holocaust survivors and why it's important to them that they keep their family stories alive. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Here in South Florida, we're a hub for some of the last living people who survived the Holocaust. But they're getting older, and it's harder for them to travel around the region and share their stories about what they lived through. Many of the survivors are in their 80s and 90s, and close to, if not 100. Now, their grandchildren are carrying on their legacies. A group called 3G Miami, or Third Generation Miami, trains grandchildren of Holocaust survivors for public speaking to help continue Holocaust education. We're joined now by two granddaughters of Holocaust survivors, Julie Pereski and Stephanie Rosen, and they're also the co-founders of 3G Miami. Julie, Stephanie, thank you so much for coming on the show. Julie, I wanted to start with you. Both of your grandparents survived the Holocaust, but your grandfather was much more outspoken about what he endured. Why do you think that is?
Well, thank you. First of all, thank you so much for having us both here. It's quite an honor to be able to speak out as we are doing and giving the support to other grandchildren of survivors. My grandfather, Otto Delicat, was very vocal, as you mentioned, and really just felt it was important to share his stories with others and make sure that the lessons and the experiences get carried forward. And that platform that we've heard often of never forget, and hopefully, you know, carry forward and don't let history repeat itself.
And he was open with you about, you know, his experiences, right? He shared it with you a lot.
He did. And he always, from when I was a young kid, I can remember he was speaking to schools and speaking to children and sharing it with us. And, you know, that's not always the case. My grandmother was very different. She wasn't as vocal, and we were fortunate to have recordings of them from the Shoah Foundation where they interviewed them. So I did hear her story in great detail, but never in an ongoing way as my grandfather spoke.
Yeah. And so fascinating because I've heard from people who sometimes they're lucky and they're able to get those stories. And sometimes it's a lot of work to try to get those stories, and it's important to get those stories. Stephanie, I understand your grandparents went through a different experience during the Holocaust. What happened with them?
So my grandparents were living in Berlin, right at this time back in 1938, when Kristallnacht first happened. They had a tailor store on Kurfürsterdamm in the heart of Berlin. And, you know, I think they got very scared. A lot of people had already left. They got very scared at that time, and they left. And they spent the entire time of the Holocaust one step ahead of the Nazis, always, you know, running through Europe, separating, hiding, you know, splitting up, sending their kids away until the war was over.
And Kristallnacht, of course, the night of broken glass. For them, you know, that night, what's the significance of that event, that evening for them and for your family?
So, you know, these anniversaries are obviously so important. My understanding how the story was explained to me, you know, that laws were changing and things were happening from, you know, the early 1930s, but they kind of lived their lives and, you know, carried on and, you know, did business, sent their kids to school, things, you know, were you know, they tried and tried. But then on the night of broken glass, I know for a fact that a store just one block away from where theirs was had their storefront shattered, just like so many. I think I've heard that 7,000 stores were you know, damaged quite badly, hence the name Night of Broken Glass, because glass was strewn throughout the streets. And so my understanding is after that night, they got very scared. And, you know, many of their friends had already left. They were lucky to maybe come over to North America. At that time, it was too late for my family to do that. But they did leave Berlin, and hence why they had to, you know, struggle and thankfully survive. But it wasn't easy hiding all throughout Europe during that time.
This particular, you know, again, the this particular evening, this particular event, Night of Broken Glass, for both of you, I wondered, how do you treat that every year? What do you think about? What do you feel? And how about how your grandparents felt thinking about it? Stephanie, let me start with you.
You know, it's interesting. I feel like, you know, going back a few years, I wasn't quite as cognizant. You know, I always knew about it, but I didn't pay like that much attention. My family moved here to Florida almost 20 years ago now. When I moved here, I started to think about it more. The Holocaust Memorial does a beautiful job, a beautiful ceremony every year. And I think I attended maybe 10 years ago and started to think about it more. At the same time, I started bringing in Holocaust survivors into my children's school to speak on a regular basis annually. It's actually how Julie and I met. Was her grandfather came in to speak to the children at our children's school. But, you know, now, especially now, it seems to be becoming more important to us as time goes on. You know that, again, like Julie said, never forget. These anniversaries help us to do just that.
Yeah. And a reminder, too, that it was 83 years ago today when Kristallnacht happened. Julie, what about for you and your family? What does that mean?
Yeah, I think like Stephanie said, in the past, it's not been that we've marked this date. I think the whole occurrence and our existence and just understanding the tragedies and the horrors and how we can learn from them has always been something very present. My grandfather only passed 3 years ago. He was a resident here in Coral Gables, actually. And so him being here was a celebration to us, I think, and, you know, a deeper reflection. But I don't think we ever convened on Kristallnacht to consider, you know, or had those discussions in that way. Although, as Stephanie mentioned, I did attend some of the ceremonies at the Miami Beach Holocaust Memorial with him And on Yom HaShoah, he was asked to light candles. And so I attended various ceremonies where he was kind of leading or participating or speaking that surrounded these events and these anniversaries.
Again, I'm talking with Julie Paresky and Stephanie Rosen. They co-founded the group 3G Miami, a group made up of grandchildren of Holocaust survivors in South Florida to carry on the family stories and to educate future generations about the Holocaust. Find out more about this group, by the way, on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Stephanie, you know, this group that you started, not the first of its kind. I mean, they're grandchildren of Holocaust survivors doing a lot of outreach. But what was, you know, when you started it, what did you want to do? What was the intention?
So, you know, you have a good point. There's actually a lot of energy surrounding this type of group throughout the country. These groups in particular, 3G groups with that name, are popping up, you know, in there's 3GNY, 3G Philly, Boston, Arizona. I mean, I can go on. There's a lot. The one that we were connected with first was 3GNY. They've been in existence for about 15 years. And Julie took their class and came to me, and I took their class, and the two of us just thought it was so wonderful and such a great way to learn how to tell our grandparents' story in a, you know, a very meaningful way, to educate students and to honor our grandparents' memory. So we really hope that that's, you know, something we can do, and mainly to educate others so that this doesn't happen again. So people are aware of the parallels that might be going on right now and, you know, what that can lead to when things remain unchecked.
Yeah, Julie, I mean, you're training these grandchildren on how to speak publicly about these stories, but also to connect with teachers and students in schools. What goes into the training?
So this training is a wonderful program that was developed in conjunction with Facing History in Ourselves. And as Stephanie mentioned, we're collaborating with other 3G groups. So the approach and this actual practice of this program has been in existence for many years. We've adapted it here, though, for our group in Miami. And we convene about 12 adult learners or grandchildren of survivors. And really, it's learning storytelling. And so how are you taking all of this information and really sharing it and expressing it so it becomes meaningful, relevant, and hopefully something that the students can start to think about and grapple with and thinking about their own attitudes and beliefs and behaviors. It's definitely a wonderful program, but it's a good amount of work for the grandchildren, and it's wonderful the outpouring we've gotten from participants, from teachers that we've already started to work with, and have speakers, you know, entering into their classrooms, and ultimately the kids, the students that we've been able to speak to have just asked such engaging questions, really, really initially positive response.
You know, I think about whenever I hear stories, when I get to sit down and talk with, you know, folks from that generation about their experiences, it just freezes me in place. And I think unbelievable that these things had happened. And I wondered, you know, as you're sharing, because these stories could be really dark and difficult to talk about, how children react initially when you tell them some of those things. And I would love to hear from both of you on this. Stephanie, what are some of those reactions you get?
All right, well, first I want to say that we really do try to gauge who our audience is, no matter what. You know, if it's people that are learning about intolerance on a corporate level, or if it's a fifth grade classroom, which typically we won't do fifth grade, but sometimes, you know, the teachers will say, well, we've been reading Number of the Stars or some other, you know, relevant book. And we have actually, just this past weekend, actually, one of our really talented speakers spoke with a group of fifth graders. And I heard that the questions were incredible. She tells her story. You know, we know there's very dark parts to the story. If she's telling her story, or if we're telling the story, we will definitely tailor the questions so as, you know, to touch lightly upon those darkest moments, but more about you know, the message of survival and what that meant without getting into, you know, all of the details of the gruesome things that, that went on in the concentration camps. Mm. I mean, the message comes across, I mean, this person's story in particular, out of a family of, I think they were 64, only two people survived. So that is definitely a message that is conveyed. But, you know, maybe not all the details of what happened. And in some cases, they don't know. But I don't know. Does that answer your question?
No, that, I mean, that's got to be really challenging to decide, you know, how much you're going to share. Because I wonder what your grandparents were thinking as they were sharing that information with you, how much they wanted to share. I don't know. Julie, what do you think?
Yeah, I think you use the word challenging, and I think it's a challenge because it is, no matter what the situation was and what your suffering was during that time, they are horrific, terrible events that occurred. I think part of sharing this is a part of history to learn from, and that is as part of the training, is how do you share these events and give an accurate recount, but not be weighing the kids down or whoever's listening
and
with
Julie,
the sequencing of those terrible events.
And Julie, do you have to, you know, make your talks, you know, a little bit more clear for the present moment? How do you get kids today to relate to your grandparents' stories?
Yeah, I think a lot of that is in the discussion after. But really, as in any good storytelling or sharing of information, history we know is not best learned through facts and figures and dates. It's kind of that human experience and that connecting and those small moments. So it's really trying to think about the ones that are going to be most meaningful. Our presentations usually only last about 15 to 20 minutes, you know, to fit into a class period for kids and making sure there's ample time for that Q&A. So I think it's really thinking about what's going to connect the most. You know, to me, my grandfather was just this positive spirit of a person, always, you know, up until the day he died a few years ago. And so to me, that's even something to share of somebody who could have survived for 6 years as a prisoner through all of these experiences and occurrences. And still, he was just the most giving, humble, and positive person I've ever known.
Mm. Where do you see this going? I mean, you know, what more do you want to see when it comes to spreading these stories out and making sure that, you know, that we're teaching this in schools, that it's getting out there to the students? Stephanie?
You know, we really are just beginning. We founded our organization back in 2020. It was, I guess, April of 2020, and we did our first training in spring of 2021, and we just had our second training. We now have 20 trained speakers, and, you know, if anyone listening is the child of a or grandchild of Holocaust survivor that's interested in participating, please reach out to us. You can find us easily on Instagram at 3G Miami or through WLRN. You know, we want to get out there. We want to get the stories heard. You mentioned earlier how long ago this was. So not only is it that we're telling some of the students something, obviously that's something they don't know a lot about, even young adults, as they're hearing these stories, you know, they learn about it. But when they hear about it firsthand from a descendant, it's very different. And it just lands differently and hits you a different way. And you're like, wow, this really could happen. And, you know, we want to get out into our community as much as possible.
Definitely, you know, hearing stories from someone who's connected to a person who survived something that we could read in a book is far, far different, far better, I think, to get that point across, without a doubt. I want to thank both Julie Pereski and Stephanie Rosen, again, the co-founder of the organization 3G Miami. And you can learn more about them on our social media, WLRN Sundial. And Julie, Stephanie, thank you so much for what you're doing and continuing to protect those legacies for the future.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And again, find out more about it on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, November 9th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, the Miami Book Fair is back. It starts next week after more than a year of virtual only. The street fair, in-person events, they're all making a comeback. And we're going to hear from the fair's director and the co-founder about the events and the authors that you should be looking out for. Plus, award-winning astrophysicist Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson is going to join us for a conversation about, well, of course, science. You're going to answer some of the questions about the universe and why going to space is not that exciting for him. He wants to go beyond. It's a fun conversation, I promise. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, you can always go back and find old episodes on our website, WLRN.org. Don't forget, we are a podcast, so you can listen anytime you want. Just find us on your podcast app. Again, just look up WLRN Sundial. As always, stay safe, be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.